Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Thank you, Brian Brown, the Brown Briefly founder and master of mirth and merriment, who could always find a bright spot even on the darkest of days, and whose sheer will could turn the fortunes of his favorite baseball team. I do remember one time leading up to the show where we were all patiently awaiting the topics we would talk about, and Brian's reply, I think, was, "My team needs me now. I'll get back to you guys later."
That's right.
So today, Tuesday, July 7th, 2020, in the year of the tweet.
Whoop. Guess what? Day. Let's try that again. There it is.
Ooh, I thought maybe our tweeter had gone off the rails somehow.
It did.
Let's see. Today also marks just 119 days, a mere 2,856 hours to the November 3rd, 2020 presidential election. And the culture wars are already going strong. Lest we forget the global pandemic. Yeah, which will soon claim 135 American lives. And just so we can put that into perspective, that is 750 737 MAX airline crashes fully loaded with all lives lost on board. That's an average of just about 6 crashes per day. So I wouldn't get on an airplane if that was happening, and I bet you wouldn't either. But also, you know, unless I've been dozing off and missed something, we still have demonstrations in the streets over the murder of George Floyd and other innocent people of color that rival the social unrest of the 1960s.
And I don't have that, sorry. That sound effect.
We all join in with crowds chanting, yes. What do we want?
Yes, yes.
When do we want it?
No.
Yay. Oh. Exactly. So today in the Gene Bosch studio in the relative calm and security of downtown Vachon, we find mood modulating synthesizer of voices from the virtual land of Zoom, complete with sound effects. Who needs autopilot airline captain and steady handed sound engineer Truman O'Brien?
Thank you. Thank you. What a nice introduction.
I'm just wondering if all the bits and bytes are behaving today, Truman.
Well, mostly. I look for your chanting crowds, and I did not find it. So I'm sorry, I missed one sound effect for you.
Maybe our listener can rally a group next week, right outside the studio.
There we go. We'll just stick a mic out the window.
Excellent. All right. Hey, next, I think we should recognize the increasingly perceptive and accurate vision of Lynn Kerrigan, poet par excellence, relocated from the land of magnolias to the island of madrones, our analytic, academic, social worker, backup singer, activist, former all-star shortstop for the Dixie debutantes. Lynn, what vision correction magnification is working best for you these days?
Hey there. I'm using a combination of drugstore reading glasses, major magnifiers, and something that I pulled off of a car that magnifies things that you wouldn't believe. Like no one's ever magnified before.
Hmm.
All right. Well, magnification is so critical these days with what is happening in our world.
And Lynn, I have to just tell you a very, very short story. I was checking out in a simulator up in Vancouver, Vancouver, Canada, and it was very dark in that particular simulator, and my vision had just started to go a bit, and so that I was having trouble seeing the instruments, and so I popped the lens out of an old pair of glasses so that I had close-up vision in one eye and distance vision in the other, and was able to get through the whole check right with a lens popped out of my glasses. So there you go.
Now we know.
Creative vision.
You had to do what you had to do. That's right.
Absolutely.
And what did your past, What did your passengers think about that, Truman?
No, it was a simulator. It was only a simulator. It was a
simulator, but
yeah, it wasn't real. It wasn't real.
Had they known?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
They figured at least his faculties weren't going. Just his vision.
Yeah, that's right. Just the vision.
Flying blind.
Yeah.
Hey, I just figured this was just another example of amazing innovation and creativity of our Alaska Airlines pilot crew.
There you go. There you go.
Deal with all the challenges that they see on those routine flights.
That's right. That's right.
Let's see. Also, beaming in through the magic of network communications, perhaps from a recent visit to another galaxy, is island historian, storyteller, international educator, and accomplished skipper Bruce Hallman, our stalwart guardian of the galaxy. And tell us, this Bruce is a historian with a good memory, the next best thing to time travel?
It comes close. As any historian will tell you, visiting the past is like visiting a foreign country. You can't make any assumptions. Everything is different. Everything has its own cultural significance in a way that it doesn't at our time and on our place. So visiting the past is not much different than visiting the future, except you don't know what's going to happen next. Or you do know what's going to happen next when you visit the past.
So, hey,
it's good to be here.
Bruce, before we move on, could I ask a quick question? And that is, on Sunday, you were involved with the recording of the COVID stories through Voice of Vashon. I just wanted to know how that went, and did you have a number of people, and how the stories went? Just can you give us a quick recap?
Yeah, it was fantastic. We had a steady flow of people coming in to tell stories. If you don't know about it, the Heritage Museum and Voice of Vashon through the month of July is sponsoring every weekend a Tell Your COVID Story, a little bit like the NPR Story Corps, except these are video recorded stories that we'll put into a sort of compilation in August. But essentially, if you have a story, just pop in and tell it. And we had some fascinating, had one fellow who broke down in tears, basically, in the midst of the story, because his wife has been isolated in England and can't get back here. And so they've been separated for 5 months now. And also just had a fellow and his son, who's about 10 years old, come and just talk about, the son talked about what it was like going to school without going to school, and sort of the challenges. And so it's just really fascinating. So for our many, many listeners out there, if you have a COVID story, please drop by. This coming weekend will be at Thriftway from 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. And along with the stories, we also have an archive collection process set up, all of it socially distanced, all sort of mask and everything to sort of prevent the spread of COVID. But if you have any artifacts, and that could be anything from a photograph to your kid's drawing on the refrigerator to a rock you've painted, whatever, that sort of conveys your experience with COVID, please feel free to come by and donate them, or to tell your story. We're really doing this so that 40, 50 years from now, people will have a sense of what we've gone through in these past 5-6 months, and looks like we'll be going through for the next 12 to 18 months.
Great. Thanks a lot, Bruce. Sorry to interrupt all the intros here, but I really thought that was important.
Absolutely. What a tremendous offer to capture our history in the making. Let's see, another welcome sight on our Zoom screens and music to our ears is master singer, thespian, half a bubble shy of plum, carpenter Michael Shook, a.k.a. Chauncey Gardner. Hey, Michael, I vaguely remember some video with a construction worker juggling a claw hammer, one of those roofing nailers, and then a battery-operated circular saw. I'm just wondering if your crew ever maybe got that started.
It's something I've heard of people doing. No, not on our crew. We were I had my hands full enough on the crew trying to manage myself and my own propensity to sing or do James Brown imitations from, say, the rooftop, that kind of thing. That was the extent of my show business stuff on the job site.
And I did.
It sounds like a juggling many factors as you were.
Exactly. Yeah. And then
Michael, can't you give us a James Brown impersonation? A little what you want or whatever it is that he said in that early screeching voice. Come on.
Ha! Jump down, jump back, kiss myself. Ha!
That's it.
Come on.
Excellent.
Thank you. It does my heart good.
Fantastic. The wonders of radio live as it comes out the microphone. Hey, I will also recognize that Susan McCabe, who is away on, we believe, a camping trip, but I just wanted to mention that Susan is one of the crew on the whole Vashon catalog, and I believe that she will have an emerging note in the Beachcomber, but you probably, if you got the Beachcomber, you now have a whole Vashon catalog, courtesy of Susan McCabe and the team there at the catalog, so just wanted to thank her for that. And let's see, lastly, yours truly, editor of Indivisible Vashon's weekly publication, for your consideration, finding far too many ways to stay busy during the stay home, stay safe. I am Kevin Jones. And today I'm the Monday.
And you're fading out, Kevin. We're losing you, Kevin.
We've lost him.
We have lost him. Kevin, we've lost you. I don't think he can hear us. So we have to get.
I'm chatting him.
Oh, good. Send him a note. And
chatting him.
Yeah, she has the capability of sending him a note
to do the chat thing.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a down at the bottom of the Zoom bar is a little chat function.
Oh,
yeah, kind of a slick deal, huh? Did you get him? Oh, there he is. Okay, we heard you that time.
Out momentarily.
Yes, yeah, you cut out almost from the minute you started talking, Kevin.
Oh, well, that can happen. That's probably edited out some good stuff there. well, I just wanted to say I'm Kevin Jones, the editor of For Your Consideration and 250 postcards to Iowa that I personally ran ink out of 4 pens to write and put in the mailbox just on Monday. So we're reaching out to Iowa voters for the election in November. Let's see. All right. Hopefully, do let me know if I drop out again. We'll fix the technical glitches. But did want to start out with last week. You know, our listener will recall we talked about the Supreme Court, who delivered yet another promising ruling this week, where states could require their electors, those are the folks who form the now somewhat infamous Electoral College, to vote for the presidential candidate who received the majority vote in their state. And you might recall in 2016, there were a couple of three electors in Washington who cast their vote for neither Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump. And that case went up to the Supreme Court and just got decided here last week. Just wondering what we think of the ruling and who might tell us about how significant that is.
Could I ask a question for clarification? I understand. There has been a number of states who have changed their rules so that it's not the vote of what the state came to a consensus on, but what nationally was being the consensus. And is that the case now? Did I get that right? I mean, and when we elect these electors, they have to vote to what the popular vote in the country is, not just the state. Is that correct?
So my understanding, Truman, is that you're referring to the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact.
Yes.
MPVIC.
That is
short.
What I'm thinking of. Yes.
And Washington, along with another number of states, which I don't recall, have adopted that. And my understanding.
I think 27 have formally adopted it.
Okay.
All right.
But this is different. This is just the states. What the state says.
Yes, that's what I understand. Okay. These are about states' rights.
Well, what I believe is they're intertwined. They're intertwined in a way that Washington, you know, has a law that's been validated by the court that says they can punish their electors if they don't vote the popular vote of the state. But when the interstate compact is now valid, when we have 270 electoral votes that are comprised by the states, then Washington will switch and ask our electors to vote in alignment with the popular national vote.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah, and that's why I think, you know, you asked about the significance of this ruling. I think it's significant in the sense that it sort of locks electors. It doesn't give the electors the choice, you know, which is a little bit sort of counter to the sense of representative democracy that we have in the United States, where you elect a representative or you elect a senator not to vote the way you want, but to vote the way that they best feel represents your interest. You know, this is a move away from that to saying, you know, to an elector, if your state votes for candidate X, then you must vote for candidate X. What I think significant about that is with that interstate compact, is that once there's enough states to swing the electoral college to vote the way the popular vote in the nation goes, then it locks those electors into voting the way the popular vote is. That's why I think it's very significant.
Lynn, please.
I have a question about this. It seemed to me in reading today's Seattle Times article, and they were talking about the three electors who got together and decided to vote for Colin Powell on the Republican ticket to throw votes away from Donald Trump. This, to me, makes me wonder if they were acting alone to make that very interesting switcheroo, or whether there was a conspiracy among other electors to try to be so bold as to really overturn his electoral college win. And I just thought that was fascinating that three people thought they could throw the vote by voting for Colin Powell. Has anybody heard more about that part of it?
Well, the bit that I heard was that also an elector in Colorado, but my understanding is that if the Electoral College doesn't deliver a clear win, then I believe the House of Representatives makes the decision about who the president is.
And so I think the Speaker of the House?
No. Actually, what's interesting about that and what's sort of frightening about it, if the Electoral College ties, it goes to the House of Representatives, and in the House of Representatives, each state gets one vote.
Oh,
not based on the number of representatives, but each state gets one vote. And when you look at the red and blue map of states, that becomes fairly frightening because there's more red states than blue states, even though there's more blue population than red population. So hopefully there would never be a tie in the House, in the Electoral College.
Interesting.
All right, I understood it too, the motivation, the primary motivation, at least from what I read, of these rogue electors was their hope that they might somehow force the issue of the Electoral College, the legitimacy of it in some way, and thereby destroy it or lead to its destruction. Because it's delivered presidents who didn't win the popular vote, I think, four times now in our country's history. So it's not the greatest system, I don't think, anymore. Maybe it's time to set it aside.
And the difficulty of that is to set it aside would take a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. And to do a constitutional amendment to revise the Electoral College opens the door to a lot of other things that you may or may not want in a change to the Electoral College. Whereas the interstate compact allows the Electoral College to stand constitutionally, but also directs the electors to vote for whoever wins the popular vote. So it's a way to make the system work, a broken system, if you will, make it work to reflect the popular democracy of whatever the popular vote is. So I think that's a stronger way to go than a constitutional amendment.
So in essence,
it's
going around it, right? It's going around
It's using the mechanism of the Electoral College, but having it enforced in a different way by having electors vote the way the national popular vote goes, rather than the vote just in their state.
So I have one more thing. I just got a text from a learned colleague who says that in all but two states, electoral votes are winner take all. The candidate winning the popular vote normally receives all of the state's votes. Maine and Nebraska have adapted a different approach using the congressional district method. These states allocate two electoral votes to the state popular vote winner, then one electoral vote to the popular vote winner in each of the congressional districts, two in Maine, three in Nebraska. This creates a multiple popular vote contest in these states, which could lead to a split electoral vote. That's what's now. So.
Who could know voting could be so complicated?
Exactly.
Well, it sounds to me like we're overthinking things. Can't we just get back to the one person, one vote? Must we have the Electoral College?
Well, one of the things that it's always got me is that when you take the big population centers like Los Angeles, you know, New York, Dallas, it really kind of overwhelms the smaller communities, does it not, Bruce? I mean, isn't that the whole reason for the thing?
Yeah,
and it all goes back to the original compromise, you know, the quote-unquote great compromise that sort of allowed, you know, popular representation in the House and two votes per every state in the Senate. And then, of course, counted slaves as three-fifths of a person. So it's a complicated, you know, flawed process from the very beginning. But the difficulty is those are in the Constitution, and they can be changed, but they can only be changed by constitutional amendment. And constitutional amendments, if you remember the Equal Rights Amendment, is fraught with difficulties. The constitutional amendments are difficult to get through, and often contain things other than what they were intended to include. And then they're open to interpretation by the courts. So my sense is, you could change it. You could get rid of it. But essentially, the interstate compromise does what Lynn's talking about, going back to one person, one vote, where in effect, the popular vote is reflected in the vote of the Electoral College. And that seems to me a very safe mechanism to get us to where we want to be.
And the Interstate Compact right now, they have enacted 196 electoral votes are represented by the people who have signed on. And there are another 120 that are pending. And of course they need 270 in order to, so it looks to me like that's very close to tipping over the edge. So basically in essence, it's going to invalidate the Electoral College. I mean, the results will be.
Yeah, and one interesting thing, we've done a comparison of those particular states who have not adopted the compact and compared that to the battleground states that we are looking at for this November presidential election, and the alignment is very close. So one strategy is to support a progressive voter engagement in those states so that they can also then have down ballot progressive votes for candidates in those states who are more likely to adopt the compact. So perhaps the Electoral College will become a thing of history in our lifetimes, which wouldn't that be awesome?
I want to make one other connection between, you know, we talk about this time in our country's history when the Electoral College was developed, and we talk about the compromise about states' rights and who will be a slave state. And all of those things to me are very tightly bound together. You know, in the book I referenced a few weeks ago called The Broken Heart of America, that's looking at racial capitalism and talking about racial politics being embedded in our very, you know, structure of our country. It was talking a lot about Missouri and the Missouri Compromise and all of the manipulations that were done at that time to try to satisfy two polarized parts of the populace, you know, the part that held for slavery and the agrarian economy, and the Union side that said, you know, we shall not abide slavery anymore. But they compromised and created the ability for some states to write into their constitution that blacks couldn't even live there. So I guess what I'm saying is that to me, we're at some point in history where several aspects of our process are open to debate. And I think that these two are so intertwined about giving states the rights to do what they feel will represent their particular state the best. But on the other hand, look how that's worked out, you know, in terms of racial equity, not so well. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that there's an answer to that. It's just a parallel that I think is interesting in historical times that we're struggling with both of them now.
Well, Lynn, as a matter of fact, you had some observations after last week's show about an important topic that we didn't really have time to get into, was but the follow-on to a discussion we had about Roe versus Wade and the Supreme Court ruling there. And that whole issue is relevant basically regarding women's health care and health care access, women's decisions. So, Lynn, I think you had some insightful comments if you wanted to share those with us.
Well, this is jumping into, you know, kind of another topic, but I'll sit with that and see if I can make it connect. But, you know, last week we were talking about how arguments can expand and deepen to hide, to mask some of the areas that are so fraught that they're not easily interpreted and not easily handled. And I was trying to say that last week that Roe versus Wade, for example, you know, starts out as, well, I believe I have the right to choose what I want to do with my body. And the other side says, well, but I believe that's still murder. And then what I said after the show was that I couldn't get to on the show was that argument deepens even further to the question of a religious belief that murder is taking place when a clump of cells are being removed from a woman's body that would become life. Because in many faith traditions, life begins at the moment of conception, as opposed to the moment of breath, which is another view of when life begins. And so then we're fraught with, do we live by the principles of a Christian state, or are we going to honor separation of church and state in the way our laws are developed so that they can encompass people of many traditions? And so, you know, at that point, I was just making a point that these arguments, which can start out seeming so innocent, so simple, when you start dissecting them, it's like any high school biology class. It just gets messier and messier and messier. So I don't know that that's erudite so much as, again, an example of thinking too much.
Well, I don't know. What do people think about those relationships and how we create these systems where we sort of live under a certain doctrine, which we may not personally feel is part of our spiritual makeup?
I find it interesting that some of the folks who are so adamant about Sharia law, we absolutely can't live under Sharia law, have the same mindset, though, from looking at a Christian set of values, saying that we can't have Sharia law, but we must live under the Ten Commandments and blah, blah, blah. I find that interesting that those same people who are adamant about that are also adamant about their method.
That's a good
point. I find that interesting.
Yeah, and what you said there, Truman, reminds me of Carl Jung's admonition to us to if we want to know what the root of the thing is that bothers us the most, then all we need to do is go look in the mirror and say out loud the thing that bothers us the most, because it's 9 times out of 10, that thing, what you just said there, for example, that Sharia law, oh, we can't have that. Well, it's, and yet it, trying to extend a different form of Sharia law, as a lot of people would consider it. It doesn't, we're not rational creatures. What can I say? And it's a very messy situation about these things.
Kevin.
So, yeah. Truman, you had a comment, right?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, this lack of equity in these decisions, the Truman, that you point out, you know, mm-hmm. why is one person's religion any more relevant or valid than another person's religion? This whole issue of separation of church and state, though, I think is interesting, Bruce, from a historical perspective, because I dug into it a little bit. And while we, all of us, have that context of separation of church and state, my understanding of maybe wasn't really codified in the founding documents in the way we all might think.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's codified in the Bill of Rights, you know, and so, yeah, not in the Constitution, but in the First Amendment to the Constitution. And what's fascinating to me is when you go back and look at the historical context of the time at which the Constitution was written, the development of the American Republic, if you will, was at the height of the Enlightenment. I mean, it is a very rational document. And it was that concern of sort of keeping out of American politics the religious elements that had so destroyed and led to revolutions and wars in Europe. And so that the idea of a separation of church and state is a fundamental idea, I think, that's very, very strong in America. But it doesn't mean that religious values don't infuse our culture, don't infuse our politics, but that the formal relationship between the government and the church needs to be kept separate. And that's where the rubber hits the road, if you will. That's where the difficulty becomes, because we are, if you will, a Christian nation in our founding, that we've become much more diverse than that. And yet those values infuse our culture. And yet at the same time, the founding document and the Bill of Rights, you know, codify the fact that church and state need to be separate to avoid the kinds of conflicts that we see happening right now.
You know, what's really interesting for me, Bruce, I had never really thought of this until you started talking, but if you think about our British ancestors who were the folks who are instrumental in those documents, if you look at the British Empire and the two religious, the Protestant Catholic whole issue there, that I'm sure was very foremost in their minds when they were drawing up these documents, thinking, I mean, they saw what kind of conflict occurred between those two religions and the state. And, if the monarch went one way, then, you know, there was conflict with everyone else. And then the next monarch comes along, he's going to go the other side. And so I'm sure that was foremost in their minds.
That, and also, I mean, you've got to remember that those early colonists who came over, many were religious dissenters, and they right. came to get away from religious oppression.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it had been infused into the DNA almost, particularly of the New England colonies. You know, right. the Southern colonies were much more religious-based than the Northern, right. religious-based than the Northern colonies. Northern colonies were very concerned about having the government control their religion, because that's why they had fled.
Right.
Whereas in the Southern states, they were founded by religious orders. I mean, Maryland was Catholic, you know, Georgia was Catholic, Virginia was Protestant. So you had a different North-South sort of split at that time that's still reflected today.
To me, what's so interesting about all of this is it feels to me like we're in a time of great testing of our documents, of our laws, of our equal application of the laws, of the formation of our laws. I mean, it's a pivotal point to me. And while some of this seems like it can be dry and abstract and entangled, I think, in a way that's hard to sort out for clarity. I think it's so important that people can kind of go back and reflect on, you know, the experiment that our country is. Nobody told us it was going to be all peaches and cream and watermelon and, you know, things that I grew up. I was thinking about my Southern childhood, you know, after World War II. It was so quiet and so peaceful and so idyllic. And it took me a long time to realize that was because my father was quiet, having fought 4 years of a war. And the blacks were quiet because they were told to be under Jim Crow laws that still existed regardless of what they had fought for in another part of the world. And so it just feels like it's an important time for us to be, you know, unraveling and kind of looking at what is working for us and what's not. And what do we need to do now? Because I hear on both sides threats of war. I hear it from the preppers. I hear it from the boogaloers. You know, I hear it from, you know, people saying I'm not leaving this occupied territory until our demands are met. We are at some pivotal point in which we need to be looking at our fundamental values.
If I can build off of that, I mean, my sense, COVID has brought on a worldwide revolution. I mean, we're in revolutionary times right now. I mean, socially, politically, economically, environmentally, we're in the midst of a revolutionary war. And what emerges from this, you know, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, will be very influenced by what we do today and how we respond today. It's not much different than other great pandemics and other great environmental changes that brought just immense changes to societies. And we're in the middle of it. It's a little hard to see because it's so chaotic. But I think we're seeing it on all levels, and that's what we're all feeling.
You know, it's really intriguing, and we may, at the risk of trying to close on this topic, which could go on for a while, but you know, Eugene Robinson, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for, I can't remember, the Times or the Post, mentioned the other day that he always thought we were a can-do country and we had the spirit and do what it took, right, to get out of a mess. But he said, it looks like we're a can't-do when it comes to the coronavirus. And so it kind of wonders, you know, we've been looking at this history and where are we at on this trajectory? And are we at a place where American exceptionalism is just lost to us now? We somehow have trouble finding our way. And then I compare that to a story from the psychological assessment of how leaders interact with societies and the amazing impact that leaders have. When Trump started talking about take a knee, he swung popular perception by 40 percentage points about that one issue. So is it lack of exceptionalism? Is it lack of leadership? Where do we think we are, and how do we get to that outcome of that revolution? Lynn, you had a comment.
I'm going to say, I'm going to take an opposite viewpoint because I feel it necessary to counterweight, you know, the inevitable, feels almost inevitable slide into isolation and depression and anger and all that. That's an easy thing to do, to slide into your emotionality. But I saw something on television that got my brain pumping again. I saw David McCullough, the historian, being interviewed on Book TV, which I didn't even know ran on C-SPAN. And he was being interviewed about his new book. He's the guy that wrote about John Adams and many other historical figures. He's quite a writer. And he's got a new book out called The American Spirit. And the thing that he talked about the most, because even though he was interviewed prior to these COVID times, so he didn't refer to any of that, but certainly the ups and downs of a a wild political process was in front of him. And he said the thing that to him marks the American spirit almost more than anything is that we have an almost endless capacity to reinvent ourselves, to invent and to reinvent, and to invent and to reinvent ourselves. And he thought that that constant turmoil, may I compare it to my compost heap, you know, was what made America so rich in its actions and in its thoughts. And I want to put some money on the fact that there are a lot more of us who can tolerate this and who are getting through it and who are being very creative and wading through it and learning from it. I'm gonna put my money on those folks.
All right, Michael, you had a comment as well.
Well, just that's interesting, Lynn. And that's I love his books. It'd be interesting to read that. I look back over the last 50 years, which is not a real long time historically, as you would, I'm sure, know, Bruce, better than most of us. But it's been a time of people talk about the culture wars, and maybe that's part of it. It's we've been in that sort of in-between space since the end of the Vietnam War, and trying to figure out what kind of a nation we're going to be, because so many people, the things that came out of that conflict, many of them were very terrible, but that whole 10, 15 years before that, many of the things that came out that, you know, I'm thinking of women saying, geez, we deserve careers if we want them. Minorities saying, hey, we deserve a life that shares in the fruits of this country too, if we want to achieve that. And a whole kind of different sort of way of looking at a democratic republic. And it seems like we've been fighting that out now for the last 50 years or so. And it's sort of now, like you said, Bruce, with this pandemic, it's like that's another catalyst, truly, and almost in the chemical sense.
I didn't get that. Let me
suggest that we've always been in that in the United States. You know, we've never been a stable democracy. We've always been struggling. You know, we were born in struggle with the revolution. You know, we struggled through the Jacksonian Revolution. We struggled through antebellum period. We struggled in a civil war, a devastating civil war. We struggled through the Gilded Age. We struggled through the First World War. We struggled through the Great Depression. We struggled through World War II. We struggled through the Cold War. We struggled through Vietnam. You know, we struggled through the collapse of communism and the emergence of a new Russia. And the culture wars have been there all along. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. It just has its particular manifestation right now. And we've had Trump-like figures in the past of all sort of ilks. America, and this is where, going back to what Lynn said and David McCullough, that our ability to reinvent ourselves and to say that is not who we are. And that's my hope for the future, for this November election and for the next 4 years, is that we can come back and say that is not who we are. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We are different.
That's great. Nice context there.
Okay, guys, we're coming upon our time here. And this to me was a most interesting show. I thank everyone very much for their input. Great. We'll see you all next week.
Happy 4th of July.
Indeed.